And I just want to mention that I'm going to go pretty quickly and turn this over to Michael Jackson here, who's from the community partner that actually prompted this whole study. It was their idea, and for a good reason. He'll explain that to you. Okay, no relationships. I wouldn't talk about them in public anyway. All right. We have a picture here of the team from St. Vincent's. This is Robert Arthur, Doris Bagsby, and the late Matt Stanford, who were trained by Wilma Subra. She's all over the place. Wilma came to town, and I'll explain later, did a training, and we all went out and used her protocols to do the sampling process. Why are we doing it? We were hit with Hurricane Ike. And I'm not going to go into Ike here. This is just about this risk communication piece. But we were hit by a hurricane. We got 9 to 22 feet of storm surge, depending on where we were in relation to the eye. And there is some stuff that is left on the surface after the surge goes away. And I have a map here that explains why we were worried about that. Okay, why and what are we doing? Okay, I don't know why I even put this on here. Everybody already knows this, but this is the level we were doing this on. You know, very, very basic. We wanted to get the word out to people. Okay? What is risk perception? Subjective judgments. Subjective judgments were all over the map when this happened in terms of what people would be facing when they came back. And we wanted to make sure that we got it as objective as possible, realizing that fear is a big factor in this. And how does it work when it's effective? Okay, you get understandable, useful stuff that you can use to make your life safer. That's really cut through all the other things and go to that. And these are the factors that seem to affect people's perception of risk. You know, how much do you know about it? How much control do you have over it? And what do you get out of it? Now, if somebody works at a petrochemical facility and makes a good living, that perceived benefit changes some of the perceptions they might have of their risk, and their family might feel the same way too. If you live on a fence line and you don't work there and no one in your community does, your perception of that benefit is way different. There is no benefit. And the knowledge thing, I don't know anything about it, it's got to be bad. Control, I can't do anything about it, it's got to be bad. So you try and show exactly how we can actually harness some of these factors. Okay, who's your audience for this? Okay, and I'm going to go down to third from the bottom. People that are likely to be affected or perceive themselves as affected. Neighborhoods and communities most proximate to risk. That had a lot to do with how we chose where we sampled. But all these other people or organizations or parties are involved in either characterizing risk or communicating to the public that characterization and what safety measures should go with it. And this other one, almost at the bottom, will be angry if not directly engaged, the exclusion factor. That's a very important thing to consider, too. Had this not been done, and honestly, I don't know whether it would have been done if we hadn't done it, because our Texas Commission on Environmental Quality did a very broad brush approach to this. They had 4 or 5 sampling points on the coast. I'm talking about the coast, not the island. And they weren't communicating it. They just said, everything's fine. Okay? Now, people don't believe that because, just a little anecdotal story, we found a whole bunch of dead alligators and nutria next to the Veolia incineration facility outside Port Arthur, Texas. Hilton Kelly called us up and said, come and see this. And there was this ethylene glycol-like stuff in pools around this facility, and these things were on the highway. And the report was they'd been hit by cars, but there were no tire tracks. So, you know, they were just dead. And why was not communicated? Okay, so I'm going to give you some excerpts from the risk characterization and communication project we did. Wilma was just so instrumental in making this happen, as was Mr. Jackson. These were the aims and objectives of this. And I hate to read things when they're so text-heavy, but we're going to determine what's there, compare with what we find with what the EPA and TCEQ found. And EPA, in the spirit of federalism, gives much of this over to the TCEQ. And they do that in every state, really. If there's a state EPA or a surrogate EPA, that's who does the groundwork. We're going to consider the risk characterizations that those two agencies had and reconcile with what we found. and develop a site-specific characterization to inform policy on the island, very important. Communicate these recommendations to the public, environmental health practitioners, and all those other people. And this was so vital and so touchy. Because, you know, how do you go in and tell the city manager, by the way, we might find a whole lot of something that's going to mean you have to do a soil abatement before you resuscitate the dead economy? And I mean literally dead. We lost about 75% of our housing for a while. Wasn't completely demolished, but, you know, people couldn't live in it. All the businesses in the downtown were defunct. They got a lot of water. You had to make it come back quickly, because you wait too long, people go away and they never come back because they need to live. So we were worried about that, and so were they. Maintain close communication with the city manager. That was part of that. Consult frequently with our local health district. They really were part of this. And I mean, not in the field or anything, but in terms of the dissemination piece. The work plan for doing this was to consult with TCEQ regarding where they did test. Okay, we got a map of that. Convene a core working group to establish project goals, and that came after a meeting at St. Vincent's House that had nothing to do with this project, where Mr. Jackson suggested the project. And the fact that there was all this dust lying around us, you know, and that had been sludge just recently, had a lot to do with his suggestion. Conduct a training in EPA-certified sampling chain of custody, the whole protocols that Wilma developed and has used in numerous other places up and down the coast for the very same reason. Deploy the sampling team based on the results, compare and reconcile methodologies, results, recommendations, and then start the risk communication process. And so this happened between October and February, October 2008, February 2009, all of this. And then we commenced the risk communication process. And here's the sequence of that. First, and I'm going backward a little bit, the urgent distribution of PPEs happened when people were reentering. And that's what I was referring to about the bilingual piece. Then there was the initial discussion, development of recommendations with our partner. And then preliminary meetings with the city manager's office, the Galveston County Health District, UTMB Public Affairs. This is a big thing. A formal presentation of results, recommendations at the City Council meeting, and our former director of our NIEHS Center and Seeley Center, Jonathan Ward, who's an environmental toxicologist, made this presentation to a packed City Council meeting, lots of people, standing room only. Everybody was really concerned about it, and he was able to give them something that was hopeful, optimistic, but guarded at the same time. And then came an urgent outreach to volunteer cadres based at Alamo School. We didn't know this because people were not able to communicate as well as they used to because of the situation. But spring break was about to bring 2,500 college students into Galveston to help clean it up. But nobody had established what they would be facing when they got there. In other words, do they wear PPEs still? Because it's going to be April. I mean, is it okay now? Are they going to have a problem after they're finished, basically? Are they going to take something home with them? And we really appreciated that they would come and help, because we needed it. But this is something that devolved on me, and I had to, every week, go into the new group, get on top of a table with a megaphone, really, and because there were all these people in the room, and do a very quick, very impromptu, and very dirty PowerPoint presentation and leafleting with these kids who were in here to help out and didn't know about arsenic, chromium, and lead, which were our primary problems, and make sure they had the personal protective equipment, which I must say we got from the industry in the Texas City area. Which they were very quick to come up with all the stuff we needed to outfit all these people who were coming as volunteers. And we were very, very thankful for that. Then we developed a Healthy Neighborhoods Recovery Communication set of materials that went through a project from our Center to Eliminate Health Disparities that was funded with SSBG money. And then we delivered this, and we delivered it, and delivered it, and delivered it, and did it in many different situations throughout the city. And this is an excerpt from what we were telling them. why we tested the soil after the hurricane, okay? The floodwater behind the seawall came from a bay that had a lot of industrial neighbors. And for close to a century, no regulations whatsoever about what you do with your waste. And it had been dumped in the bay, okay? There were possibly accumulations of toxic materials. We already had a fish consumption advisory. We have it in the entire bay because of dioxins and PCBs. We have a new Superfund site at the very mouth of the San Jacinto River where it joins the bay, and that's a dioxin paper mill waste dump that had been built on the shores of the San Jacinto River, and then the river changed its boundaries, and now it's inundated all of it. It's all fallen apart, basically, and now it's cordoned off, and the EPA is fixing it, but this is another backstory. They're still looking for a responsible party to bill, and so it's kind of going slow. And so we needed to know whether sediments contain significant toxins or not and where, because there would be rebuilding going on. There are special land uses like gardening. That was a big issue. For healthcare planning, what were we going to face? And to address environmental justice and health disparities concerns. As it turns out, the neighborhoods where we found the most toxins were the neighborhoods that had EJ concerns before the storm. Okay. This is where we sampled, and we were trying to catch all the water bodies that might possibly have important things in it. The East Galveston Bay connects with the Texas City and the Houston Ship Channel, and that would be the source of the dioxin and PCB, and maybe hydrocarbons. The center of the island, we have the Galveston Ship Channel in between Galveston Island and Pelican Island, and that's a heavily industrialized area too, and right across, you don't see this in the map, across from Pelican Island, there is a Superfund site that was dumping arsenic into the water. It isn't anymore, it's been abated, but the stuff is still there. Metals don't move around that much unless the dredging is happening. This hadn't been dredged in a few years, so we consider that, not in play before the storm. And then we went down to the bottom of the island here, the western end. We're looking at Chocolate Bayou, that connects with Freeport, which is sort of up in this area, and that's a heavy petrochemical area also, and also pesticides. And this is all produced and manufactured in this area. So how did we do the soil testing? Okay, first we learned the process of how to collect a sample that is credible and would stand up in court if that came to it. This is something that involves the chain of custody, and Wilma Subra conducted this study, training process at St. Vincent's House. And here's a picture of Matt scraping a layer of sediment underneath a bench in a park where children play a lot. Now, at this point, there weren't a lot of children back, but there would be soon. What were we looking for? Semi-volatiles, asbestos, sulfur compounds, toxic heavy metals, highly persistent organics, and diesel range organics. And what we found. Okay, anything in red exceeds the EPA residential standard. Anything in blue is of concern. Anything in black is okay. There are two standards, however, because you see a lot of these, especially arsenic, many, many exceedances. But we didn't exceed any of this 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 100,000 protective level, less precautionary, that the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality used to assess risk. Now, this is comparable to what the FDA did with the Gulf oil spill. They did change what they considered protective and safe in terms of evaluating the quality of the seafood because of what had happened. Well, TCEQ is doing the same thing here. So, no red flags went off statewide, but this is something to be concerned about, and maybe Wilma would like to comment on that later. And so these are the three things that we found to be the most problematic, and this was part of our outreach. We explained to everybody about lead, about arsenic and chromium, what it may trigger, what health effect it might produce, and how you would, the route of exposure. And talked a little bit about, and this was the hardest thing to communicate. Why are there two risk assessments? Why do we have a difference? Why is TCEQ less protective than EPA? What does that mean? And what does it mean in terms of time, over time? I can't say that I fully answered that to everybody's satisfaction, because many people don't believe that our homegrown regulators were that concerned about it. I could see that they were. Everybody was trying to balance the economic revival and safety, and it was a difficult thing to communicate. And instead of, you know, answering questions, I would be asking them here of people who are more well versed at this. How safe are we? What should we do? And this is what we told everybody. We had a general burden of lead on the island. We're considered the most lead-infested area of Texas. So we already had a risk burden we were carrying there, and this adds to our cumulative risk. And now chromium and arsenic does not help the situation any. We recommended that families clean up the sediment if you had kids and they'd be playing in it. You don't want them ingesting it. You don't want them getting it on their skin. And in the early part of the disaster, this stuff was also aerosolized. As they were grinding things, we had a giant debris pile and it was being ground up before it would be hauled away. We had a huge cloud over the island for about a month. And everybody was exposed to it that was there. Luckily, very few people were there at that point. That's the only thing I can say about that. Because I was there, and I wasn't wearing a mask or anything like that. So, okay. And then we also recommended that if you have vulnerable individuals in your family, that you consider their exposure to. We had intense discussions about what vulnerability is. We did a little workshop activity where people would try and identify somebody who was vulnerable, depending on who I'm talking to. Our workshops went to the housing authority people. That was a sort of a mid-range approach, and it went to people who were working with children in daycare facilities, some of which weren't up and running yet, but were about to. And it went to people that were working for the city, actual city workers, not the planning people or the higher echelons, but the people who are actually touching this stuff. And we got very basic about it, but this was a really good thing. Visualize somebody you know that you consider vulnerable. Okay, why? We talked about what vulnerability is in just real concrete terms, not social determinants of health kind of thing or anything like that. Yep, 2 minutes? Okay. And sensitive subpopulations. We told everybody to use protective equipment to prevent exposure when cleaning up sediment, and I'm going to really motor now. And gardening was the thing that everyone talked about. That was the most important thing on everyone's mind. How can I garden again? Is it safe to do that? So raised beds, of course, were what we recommended. And also bioremediation, if you want to grow a lot of sunflowers for 2 or 3 years. And you might be able to suck up all the lead, arsenic not so much. And I don't know that it does it with chromium, does it? Okay. And then these are the ongoing things that came out of this process. We now do disaster preparedness workshops that are a lot more comprehensive than this. And a rapid response surge sediment sampling and analysis protocol is set and ready to go as long as Wilma's around. We're going to always have Wilma over, and she's never going to leave us. And coastal resiliency is part of our Encuentro process, which is an environmental justice meeting we do every year that brings together community groups from all over the Gulf, from Alabama to West Texas. And these are some of the previous things we did in the area of risk communication. The ones that were the most challenging was the VX hydrolysate incineration risk to Port Arthur, Texas. This showed up on their doorstep with no prior notice. DOD did it, and it was a Homeland Security thing, so they didn't talk to the public about it. But the public found out, and they thought they were getting VX nerve toxin. In a sense, they were, but it was cooked with sodium hydroxide first. And then the PCB NEPA waiver that also happened in Port Arthur. We do this a lot. We have a lot of things like this happening in our area. And this is what we'll be working on in the future in terms of risk communication. Hydrofracking, big issue on the Barnett Shale and in the Eagle Ford Shale. The tar sands oil transportation and refining thing at the endpoints. And we have two environmental justice communities that are receiving this really sulfurous oil. They've already been identified as EJ communities, and they're about to get this. And so this will be another issue. The BP oil spill, we'll be working on that for a number of years. And then we are in conjunction with Airlines Houston, Tejas, CETA from Port Arthur, and Citizens for Environmental Justice from Corpus Christi, developing a Texas Gulf Coast ports network. And we're also going to try and extend that to Gulfport and Biloxi because they are having an expansion issue, too. what happens to communities when their ports expand to accommodate the widening of the Panama Canal and the more traffic we're going to be getting in the Gulf. And here we are. These are the people I'm acknowledging. And Michael Jackson, would you like to say something about how this idea came to you and why you wanted to do this?
I'm not going to take any credit. If you look at the map, St. Vincent's House is the middle and the closest to the bay. Two blocks away from the bay. So we got a lot of water at St. Vincent's House here. And we're the only thing left standing. We're a two-story building. And when John asked, it was the muck. Y'all call it sediment, but after the storm, there was something on the ground that I can't tell you what it was. But after this study, we know what was in it. And we would scrape it off and rain and would come back. And it was very aromatic at best and stuck to everything. And I called John and said, John, there's something over here maybe we need to look at. And again, meetings with St. Vincent's House, because St. Vincent's House was the only thing standing. This doesn't exist anymore. It was public housing. Development is torn down. We don't have any public housing.
Four developments torn down.
And not replaced.
And not yet. And we're still going through that process. Supposedly it's supposed to break ground in June of 2012. Don't hold your breath. And that's it. You know, we were there, but I would say the network that was already established, Linda came and trained our people. We got back early because we were first responders, and we lost the whole first floor, which we just completed and brought the preschool back in June. So it's a very long process. Anybody that's been involved in any kind of environmental event, flood. Everybody saw your pictures of the flood. You know, when I went home, I saw my refrigerator turned over and everything someplace else. And I said, oh, I'm not coming back here for a while. But I saw it in Katrina. And I went to do work with Katrina. But we have to get the information out, assess the risk, let people know what it is, because as that bag says, we're trying to build healthier communities. If you don't have healthy people, you can't have healthy communities. If you breathe and touch this stuff, and I'd like to dedicate this whole thing to Matt Stanford.
I agree.
To die of cancer after that, a year later. Not to say that was responsible, you know, but he was healthy one day and he was gone the next.